And what is the, I know I, you're not, never supposed to ask anyone this, but when can we expect to start seeing some of this in print?
Define imprint. Do you mean when will my dissertation be done, or do you mean when am I publish an article?
I left it vague because I didn't want you to know.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke in a lavishly redecorated home studio.
Yes. Studio 598 is looking looking totally different these days.
It is. It's I can see there's a file cabinet, and the file cabinet has a printer with a Christmas tree on top of it.
That's correct.
Above that appears to be a piece of concept art that is a bunch of pills spilling out of a an urn. Is that what I'm seeing?
It's an IKEA fake plant, actually. So it's hanging from the ceiling.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And then to
yeah.
the right, you have Elton John's mirror.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And the chair that, according to my family lore, was owned by the man who created Monopoly at one point.
No kidding. But he had to sell it to make money to pay off the cost of producing Monopoly?
I don't know. I should have put more details on it, but it's one of these, it's old enough that I'd be curious to take it to an antiques roadshow sometime.
There you go. And you easily could, because you are so close to Montana. You could just cut down. our sponsors this fortnight are the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick and Ken's Professional Development Fund. So we thank both the APANB and Ken for that.
Faculty of Arts and Science at the University of Lethbridge.
And so, Ken, one of the things that our astute listener may have noticed is that even as we get close to 50 episodes of this podcast,
very close,
we've gotten into the high 40s, and we still do not have a new name for this podcast.
That is true.
And so, Ken, we wouldn't ever just take the intellectual property of one of our listeners. We would ask them to give us the name, but in return, we would sort of compensate them in a way that would minimize their tax obligation.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. And so.
Yeah. We don't issue tax receipts, but
we don't issue any kind of receipt. That's the crucial.
That's true.
Yeah. And in fact, so Ken, I think, you know, as we're talking about getting to the end of the year here, and we're starting to think about kind of taking stock with where we stand with our physical, mental, and spiritual health. And Ken, I think one of the occupational hazards of this line of work that we're in is that we spend so much time looking back, you know, as archaeologists, we're always looking into the past. And we sometimes don't think about how we can be our best selves for the future. And sometimes, Ken, as my graduate student used to say, you need to look out for number one. And so, Ken, it's no secret that...
which grad student was this?
that was Chris. Yeah, and that's good advice, Ken, because it's no secret that you and I both advocate destigmatizing mental health struggles in archaeology, whether they be mood disorders, PTSD, depression, or the substance use and eating disorders that so often come for archaeologists. At the same time, we recognize that our listeners are some of Canada's finest archaeologists, allied professionals, and enthusiasts. So, Ken, this holiday season, we've got a very special opportunity to look back to take care of ourselves, or rather to have the lucky listener take care of himself, and make next year not just happy, but mentally healthy. So, Ken, travel with me for a minute to the Amazon, sometime between 1500 and 2000 BC. Are you visioning this, Ken? Are you manifesting this?
I am.
Okay, excellent.
Yep.
And I'm going to...
Lush jungle.
Yep, exactly. And look around, and we're sitting in a large circular structure. The sweat on your shirt has formed its classic Care Bear Ken pattern. Looking around, you notice that...
Tender Ken.
Tender Ken. It's not Care Bear Ken. Well, here it's Care Bear Ken. And looking around, you notice that we're surrounded by anthropomorphic figures, a large ceramic jaguar, and a pottery snuffing tray. There are three katanas over the mantle, which you immediately recognize as the international and time immemorial symbol of an avocational pharmacy. But then you look down, Ken, and you realize that that Care Bear, as I said, pattern has formed on a Lacoste polo shirt. It's not your usual Eddie Bauer moisture-wicking woven tech shirt in beige. And what's more, your usual olive drab pants have been replaced by a Brooks Brothers Nantucket red short. Or maybe it's Nantucket green, you can't really tell. You notice that the tan pattern on your legs suggests that this isn't the first time you've been wearing boat shoes without socks this summer. And besides your tastefully sized Rolex watch, you notice a surgical steel-grade magnetic bracelet. There's no doubt that this is helping to balance your chi. As you look around at others like you, you feel an overwhelming urge to vomit. No, not because you're surrounded by other overpaid capitalist parasites who've earned their keep through usury, lobbying, and underpaying their employees, but because you've just consumed an enormous amount of ayahuasca. You're a high-powered CEO on a psychedelic retreat, and your mental health has never been better. And this is when it hits you, Ken. This isn't about what the past was. It's about what the future could be. And so, listener, just let that sink in for a minute. Let me refer you to the December 12th issue of the New York Times. Quote, "The CEOs are tripping. Can psychedelics help the C-suite?" And Ken, let me be frank. The article goes on to describe the sort of people I don't think you and I would like very much. And I think our dislike for them would be exceeded.
I think you might be right.
And I think our dislike for them would be exceeded perhaps only by their dislike for us. But after describing one particularly obnoxious one of these creatures, some sort of gas executive who after years of wrecking the planet had a failed IPO and a failed marriage and so became a yoga instructor and traded the cocaine and lewds for shrooms and Baby Bella-sized peyote buttons, the story says, and I quote, "It was as if he had thrown his ego into a dryer and watched it shrink, and he became intent on helping others with that same kind of cosmic laundering." But Ken, there's nothing about an ayahuasca trip that says you need an MBA to be engaged in some sort of intrinsically evil lifestyle. Although if you are and you'd like to sponsor the program, where would they email us, Ken?
NewBrunswickArchaeology@gmail.com. That's NewBrunswickArchaeology, all one word. NewBrunswickArchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. It's not just your ego that can be laundered that way. We'll also launder your hard-gotten spoils. But like I was saying, Ken, this is where we come in. Because, listener, we know you like to perform your best. And sometimes you just need to turn on, tune in, and drop out. Turn the frontal lobes off and turn them back on. What's good for the C-suite is good for the lab. But you don't need to buy the ticket to take the ride. We'll be the ticket for you if you're the lucky listener to rename this podcast. And let me tell you, listener, in the bad old days, Ken and I might have just stolen that name from you, but not now. Listen, and that's because we've each personally experienced ego death at this retreat we're going to send you on. So, listener, if you rename this podcast, we'll be sending you on a 6-day ayahuasca meditation and Bikram yoga retreat in the Amazon jungle along with the official guru of the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. That's right, listener, yoga at sunrise, daily trips to waterfalls, and meditation at the Amazon's premier hummingbird sanctuary. All of your meals will be vegan and prepared by a chef who's engaged in a 3-week ritual cleanse before even thinking about picking up a knife. And then after dinner, it's time for a little Ayurvedic oiling while you sit around the campfire and chant mantras. And then, Ken, you'll be handed a mug of the strongest ayahuasca known to man and spend the next 6 hours alternating between introspection and feelings of connection and unity, between diarrhea and vomiting, between euphoria and panic, and between auditory and visual hallucinations. But most of all, Ken, you'll emerge with the distinct sense that you've had your psyche completely laundered, and that after a week of this, you'll be the best archaeologist or archaeology enthusiast you can possibly be. That's right, listener. Isn't it time you embraced multiple modalities for mental health to peak performance? And we'd love nothing more than to get you on that flight to the Amazon, so run, don't walk to your computer to send in the new name for this podcast. And Ken, where would the lucky listener send the winning entry to rename this podcast?
They're going to send that entry into newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled A-R-C-H-A-E-O-L-O-G-Y, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right, listener. Not only do we discover it's all one world, it's all one word. And Ken, if you listen into that mailbox, what do we have in there tonight?
What do we have? Let's see here. We've got some emails from Podcorn and Spotify. You know, it doesn't matter if you say to unsubscribe from Podcorn, they seem to just keep coming.
That's probably just how they know you're real.
Yes. Yeah. So we've got one here from titled Social Media Blue Sky.
Which is like a Twitter replacement, is it not? Or an X replacement?
Social media site Blue Sky. Yes. I thought this one may be spam, but this looks like it might actually be a real episode. Gabe, or real email. So it says, Gabe, Ken, I really enjoy your podcast. Great material, great presenters, and great repartee between the hosts.
Oh, it's lovely. Ken, even if this is fake, I love it already.
Yeah, really. Eh? I recall in your last episode, Enough About Archaeology, Let's Talk About Ourselves, one of you, I don't recall which one, mentioned that you would upload your most recent research paper to your LinkedIn account, which I know researchers use as an open discussion review forum. As an alternative, or in addition to LinkedIn, wait a second. Is this somebody who's a listener and this is an advertisement? As an alternative or in addition to LinkedIn, Blue Sky serves as an online meeting place for researchers to share ideas, research, preprints, etc.
Is this possibly AI?
I don't know. I've attached a recent science article detailing the site as an alternative to X. Note, I am not employed by Blue Sky, nor do I derive any financial benefit from the site. Just thought I'd share the info with you both. Keep the great work. I always look forward to the latest installment of the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. P.S. Keep the name of the show as is. Familiarity with site and format fosters community of viewers and greater overall engagement, in this case, the listener. In other words, don't F with a good thing. Yours, Patrick, Massachusetts fan.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Patrick.
Yeah.
Perhaps one of the strangest emails we've received, but I...
yeah.
Is Patrick a person we know?
That would be a really elaborate AI.
Is Patrick a person we know? Like, do you recognize them? Don't share the... The name, right?
No, it's an AOL address.
That sounds pretty real.
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting.
So, Patrick, I'm going to tell you this. I am incredibly proud that I never took part in Twitter, and I will be even more proud that I will never take part in Blue Sky. So,
But we would happily... You know, we'll read the first part of your email over and over again on air. We might even take it and just post it to our website.
Yeah, it is. It's like the article he sent is talking about how that there's a bunch of people moving over to Blue Sky basically to share their research.
This is what I've heard. Our mutual friend Bill Farley is very active on the internet and was explaining it.
Yeah. So I tend to minimize my social media involvement, but it's good to know that Blue Sky is also out there. I don't really like LinkedIn, but it seems to be one of the best ways to kind of share. And it's a fairly, the CRM community is very present on LinkedIn, which I think is actually a very good thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. But no, I also don't really have much use for for these things.
Okay, so the next one is it's actually an email that we should we'll have to get back to this person. So Trish writes, hello folks, I found this stone while beachcombing at low tide near the blockhouse in St. Andrews. I'm wondering if it is a cutting tool. I'm not sure if the pictures do it justice. I found your YouTube channel and Instagram page very interesting. Thanks, Trish. And Trish, that indeed looks like it looks like a pretty battered up piece, but it is definitely a stone tool. Here, I'll share my screen with you for a moment, Gabe. I don't know if this is going to, hopefully this doesn't screw up the...
Cool.
Let's see here. Get Gabe's analysis. Gabe loves rocks. So.
I love rocks. Yeah, but this looks... Oh, yeah, that looks to me to be a tool of some kind.
Yeah, big spalled flake with probably like a spoke shave edge on it and a couple of retouched margins here. So, Trish, short answer...
It's had a time in the water, though.
It's definitely been in the water for a little while. Short answer is we will provide you with the, we'll write you back and send you the information for the province. That's the first person to reach out to. But you definitely did find a stone tool, and it's great that you reported it, and we will make sure that you get that reporting handed off to the proper folks as well.
That's right. Thanks for writing in, Trish, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, yes. And both Patrick and Trish, again, we'll write you back, but now that we can send mail again, we'll be sending out some postage.
That's right.
So we're good to go.
And Ken, I'm still seeing your screen here.
Oh, okay. Well, you just saw that the some other... This is definitely not a legitimate email.
No, that appeared to be something masquerading as Norton Antivirus.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I just gave my computer a virus. So.
Yes, I was going to say.
Yeah, I think that's
that
it.
Was not Norton and St. John committed listener. That was fake Norton. Antivirus.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, it was the email name is Mervin. So anyway, yep. That's probably just a little bit of malware on my computer now.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the new feng shui in Ken's home office is gonna prevent any possible attacks on his computer. I would say it's completely safe.
Yeah, exactly. And then the rest of it is we've renewed our Apple Podcasts Connect account, some new subscription agreement or something like that.
That's right.
And we've got newbrunswickarchaeology.com for another year, listeners. So if you're for all of your archaeology needs and a website that we hope will grow in influence and information over the next year. The newbrunswickarchaeology.com, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, for all of your archaeology needs, and newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com for all of your queries and stories and any other information you want to share.
That's right, Ken. Am I correct that there are no spaces anywhere in either that URL or that email address?
No spaces. It's a nonstop journey of New Brunswick archaeology.
That's right. So if you're thinking about hitting, you don't need any thumbs to enter that into your URL. Just use the four fingers right on the front.
You hit the border at Edmonston. You don't stop till you're past Sackville.
I actually sort of like to type it in, kind of like, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis playing Great Balls of Fire. I just use my my heel to do the AEs. I think is a nice touch.
Yeah.
But that's a thing. So you end up at the wrong website, but it's still kind of a fun way to do it. So thanks to everyone who wrote it. And so Ken, speaking of phenomena, like Jerry Lewis, exactly. We're taking our listener on a cosmic journey momentarily, because we're going to be. This is very confusing because we've stepped dramatically out of time.
We have. This will become all the more confusing when in 15 minutes we are recording the next episode.
That's right. Yes, it will. I can hear that the TARDIS is gunning its engine as I wait. But we're going to be joined by David Milley, and let's see, I guess we know David Milley because he was an undergraduate at UNB.
Yep. I think he helped both of us in the lab at one point.
He did, basically. Although he helped me in the lab when I wasn't there.
Right.
He did some mapping for Dave Black and I, and as that would imply that he was that sort of precocious undergraduate, he is doing a bunch of interesting research that sort of melds philosophy and geophysical techniques, and includes places like Poverty Point in the American South.
Yep. So we take a journey down to the southeast, and David, who is a PhD student at the Graduate Center at City University of New York, will take us on that journey.
That's right. And listener, you're going to notice right at the beginning that it's not just phenomenology that we can relate to David Milley about understanding. It's that he likes to listen to the program and to write during 4 hours since the gym. So naturally we had a lot to talk about right out of the gate.
Exactly.
Talk to
you soon, listener.
Yeah. Happy Swole Days, listener. Today we're joined by David Milley, who's currently a PhD student in anthropology in the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Prior to this, he earned his MA in archaeology from the University of Calgary, and before that, his BA at the University of New Brunswick. He also has a certificate in GIS from Hunter College, CUNY. His work has appeared in the journal Ancient Mesoamerica, and his master's thesis was entitled Hydrological Landscape Analysis of a Sinuous Depression, Yaxchilán, Mexico. He's also been involved in cultural resource management, and his research now focuses on human-environmental interactions. Welcome to the program, David.
Yeah, welcome to the program, David.
Thanks for having me.
You're fulfilling our content that we've promised the listener this season about human environmental interactions. So
yes.
we welcome you with open arms.
Yes, we've been setting this up all season so far.
Yes, that was definitely the intention the whole season.
Yeah, exactly. It was a good thing you wrote in from the bath when you did.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I have migrated to listening to you guys at the gym as my workout tracks now.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Shifted. Yeah.
Yeah,
because Ken talks so fast that it just really...
It's like having Metallica on or something, right? Like that's it's just...
Yeah. No, to be completely honest, I usually used to listen to audiobooks. So
okay.
If you're there all the time, you start to get bored of music.
I wouldn't know. I've never spent that much time.
I wrote half my master's thesis sitting at the side of the gym because that's when I got most of my ideas happened while I was doing some type of physical activity for some reason.
So did you have like a laptop on your lap while you're doing like leg press or something?
Nope. Oh, wow. I had my phone, and between sets, I would go sit on the edge. Although I say between sets, which sometimes ended up being an hour between sets. And I was at the gym for 4 hours, of which three was writing. So,
wow. All right. what are you working on these days? And in particular, maybe you could just give us sort of an overview of your current dissertation project. And then we'll ask you a bit about the kind of technologies you're integrating into that work.
Okay, for sure. So currently, as you said, I am a PhD candidate at the Graduate Center CUNY. So that's the City University of New York. And I am doing just the write-up for my dissertation now. My dissertation, basically, I'm centered on human-environmental interactions and archaeological method and theory are the big kind of two areas of focus. And specifically, my dissertation uses phenomenology and GIS and creates a dialogue between those two methods to try to develop and demonstrate a few different things. So the authoritative superiority of blending quantitative and qualitative data, but also I'm trying to bridge that divide between what is deemed scientific and quote-unquote non-scientific archaeologies and a lot of the tension that exists there. And in doing all that, one thing I'm really, kind of the big thing in my dissertation is I'm actually developing a method to use GIS and phenomenology in combination, which has recently, well, writing my methods section up means that so far I have over 100 pages for one chapter, which is a lot of writing. But
I'm going to give you a tip here, David. You should start cutting things at the gym when you get excited. You should sit at the, yeah.
And just before we get too much further, for the listener, could you kind of contextualize what you're using phenomenology as, sort of like a kind of a layman's version of it?
I mean, so the most layman's term of like I would say is using individual personal experience of places to kind of use as archaeological data, I guess. And I think the best way to kind of explain how I'm using those is to kind of give a story or brief story of how I got here in the first place. So when I was doing my master's at the University of Calgary, which was in Mesoamerica, not University of Calgary, but my dissertation, my research was in Mesoamerica. I mean, maybe it is, I don't know. But I worked amongst the Maya. But when I first went to the University of Calgary, obviously, like most students, you don't get to go to the field in September, right when you start. You have to at least wait till the summer and once you get all the funding figured out. So in the meantime, my supervisor gave me a bunch of LIDAR data of this site. I had no clue what the specific project I'd be working on was, nor did I ever have any kind of comprehension of the landscape itself. So she gave me these data sets, and it was actually my first time working with LIDAR data. LIDAR data is essentially an elevation map composed of thousands of data points that is collected via some type of remote aircraft, so UAVs or drones, or in this case, it was a plane. And it has just a laser rig on it that shoots millions of laser pulses at the ground. Those laser pulses bounce back up. It records the time delay between when it was shot and when it came back, and then doing some math in the background, it calculates the distance that light traveled. And doing that for all these points, it can basically create a map of the elevation of the terrain that, because lasers are so they're so small, they're able to penetrate between vegetation, and as you've all seen, leaves and vegetation also doesn't block 100% of light, so they can even go through it. So anywho, I was provided with this large data set of elevation points about a site in a place I'd never been. And I was told, hey, we think there's a bunch of canals in this landscape. here's the data, take this GIS course and analyze it. So I spent the whole first year working with this data, studying linear features throughout the landscape, doing modeling of the hydrology, which basically uses those elevation points to create a computer-based model of how the water would flow, based on pure assumption that water always flows downhill. So it just traces the flow of water. So by the end of that year, I had in my head this image of Yashnoka and the area of interest that based on this hydrological model, this model of the flow of water. I had pictures of where streams would be, how this all interact. This was a tropical rainforest, so I had a mental idea of what that meant. And based on all the computer models of how water flowed and this mental idea of what tropical rainforest and all this meant, I went to the field in that summer with kind of a preconceived notion of what I was going to experience. And this is where the experience of the phenomenology part comes in, because as soon as I arrived at the field, I was struck by how different the actual landscape was from the ideas and notions instilled in me while using this technology. Specifically, there's no flowing water. There's never any flowing water, because the entire Yucatan Peninsula, so that's where Yashnoka is, it's like the southern peninsula of Mexico, sits on karstic bedrock. So this is basically means the whole peninsula sits on this massive slab of porous limestone, and all the water just goes into the ground. It doesn't really flow on the surface. And in the places where it doesn't go into the ground, that's because there's such large clay deposits. And so it's just stagnant pooling there. So to me, that was really a kind of abrupt difference between my experience in the place based on my perceptions and senses and what this technology saw. And I mean, I could go into more detail about my master's, but the point there is that I came out of my master's research with a real appreciation or idea that there is these technologies using remote sensing are very powerful. The amount of, like, they helped identify a lot of features and things that wouldn't otherwise have been identifiable. But I had worries. And I was a bit bothered by the fact that archaeologists continue to use these technologies due to their interpretive and analytical power without actually considering the experience of place and the being in the place.
Yeah. And yeah, you kind of can't exchange the, like, working at an actual site and experiencing what that landscape is like and everything like that for this sort of top-down Cartesian perspective of what's happening there, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly it. And so anyway, that ultimately led into my dissertation. But the question you asked was, can you explain what phenomenology is? And I think what it really comes back to is, it is that sensory experience in my point of view. And one thing I really wanted to emphasize is that people have criticized GIS on the one hand, which is a really powerful tool. GIS is just a suite of technologies for looking at geospatial data, so data that has a spatial component, which for archaeologists usually means like digitalized old maps or aerial imagery or LIDAR data, which I described. So that usually tends to be what archaeologists use. And then GIS, or geographic information systems, just is a technological suite that allows you to analyze those data, manipulate them, and identify patterns. And the biggest critique that's been leveled at GIS is one of environmental determinism, and one that it being very objective without considering subjective variables.
Yeah, like stuff like least cost path analysis that, you know, that you assume that humans are always going to follow kind of the...
Interstate 95.
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I just wanted to tell you guys, don't worry about it. We'll get Emmanuel to put in do-do-do-do-do every time you say phenomena. So it's all sorted out. We'll handle that in post-processing.
Yeah. I'll be looking forward to that. I expect it there now.
Yeah, Emmanuel. Excellent. Yeah.
Well,
and so where are you applying
this? Patiently anticipate our lawsuit from the Jim Henson estate. There.
So, yeah. And so where are you applying this this work now? You're wearing a Poverty Point t-shirt, I see.
Yeah, so the short answer to your question is that, yeah, I am. My current research is using Poverty Point as a case study.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And what is Poverty Point for our listeners?
Well...
What
is it? Well, the simple answer is it's an archaeological site. But the real answer is, so Poverty Point is, and actually it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, but the significance of Poverty Point, which I think is the real interesting thing, is that it is a complex of earthworks in northern Louisiana near the border with Mississippi. And it dates to the late Archaic period, which... You're going to have to excuse me while I actually get you the date ranges. Well, somebody can insert that later. Mainly because I don't remember I'm not good with dates. But anyway, it dates to the late Archaic. And it's unique because it is the largest late Archaic earthwork complex in North America. And it, in the 2,000 years preceding and following Poverty Point, the Poverty Point earthworks building period, there is not really any other comparable earthworks built in terms of expanse. And to give you a brief description of the site, and I want to make it clear to the listener that my research interest, like Poverty Point came second. It ended up coming along as a, this works with what I want to do. But the site's relevance was because it provided criteria that fit my project. And it was a case study. It wasn't the main focus. So I am by no means a super large expert on Poverty Point. But it's a unique site.
It's for the Cajun audience. We like to include some Louisiana here.
That's valid. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So... It is, well, you know, that's that the Acadians might like this, so.
Yeah, that's what we were thinking.
Yeah, so Poverty Point, it contains, so it's six mounds in the main site. One of them is the second largest mound in North America, after Monk's Mound, which is a Mississippi mound. And I've never seen Monk's Mound, but it's... So Poverty Point has six mounds in the main site. One of those six, though, is later. It dates to sometime during the Woodland period. It's a Coles Creek mound. So and it's built atop another earthwork at the site. So the most unique feature at the site beyond is the fact that it has six concentric rings. So if you picture Poverty Point is located at the periphery of this... ridge, this Mason Ridge, which is a massive 100-kilometer-long ridge that tapers slowly down to the Mississippi floodplain level to the west. But on the eastern side, it's kind of this, again, I'm going to put this in quotes, sheer cliff. Now, that sheer cliff is 20 feet. So, but everybody there describes it like that. And this kind of leads back to the experience part. But anywho, so abutted against this ridge cliff is on the ridge side, six concentric rings with the opening. If you picture them like the letter C, it's basically six C's, one after another, with that opening of the C abutted against the edge of this ridge, which is essentially a natural barrier. And down this 20-foot drop, and I'm saying it in feet because that's all they talk about, and I didn't measure it in meters,
thousands of meters.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. That's the phenomenological experience. Easily dozens of meters.
Is a bayou, which, if anybody doesn't know what the difference between a bayou and a river is, there's not much one except Bayou Slow, and it's in Louisiana.
And Linda Ronstadt only sings about the one.
Exactly. Yeah. There's not really any difference. So a bayou is a river that moves slowly, which in some places is just a river. And so these six rings open onto this natural barricade. And in the middle is a massive open flat expanse that is called a plaza. It's called a plaza because it's a massive open expanse, because other such expanses in the world have been deemed plazas. So there's not a necessary connection there in terms of the reality of the poverty point. It's more, oh, this looks similar. Archaeological work has shown that this plaza is actually constructed in the sense that the entire thing is an earthwork. It has been leveled. Erosions from the adjacent bayou have actually, like, erosional gullies have been filled in the past. So in this plaza, there's one mound. It's a really odd mound. It's called Mound C. And if you take the center point of these ridges, you like bisect the seas, that is where the largest mound is. If you continue to the west, it's called Mound A, and that's the one that's just as small, just a little bit smaller than Monk's Mound. On a north-south axis,
the one that they think might be a bird, or some people.
Yeah, so there is this like bird theory where people have suggested they see it as a bird in flight. I think it looks more like a mushroom than any sort of bird. But I'm not, again, the amount of erosion on the sides is why it looks like a mushroom. I don't know. It's like one of those Warshawk plots. You can see whatever you want. I don't know. Maybe you'll see a toad, but I'm not sure.
It all depends on your personal phenomenology.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. Anyway, I don't see a bird. But anyway, on a north-south axis against this, there's two more mounds. And then there is... So there's a couple more mounds around it, basically, that are outside of the main site area. And the most interesting thing about Poverty Point is that none of the mounds have anything in them besides the building activities. Unlike later mounds, there's no burials or so forth. And there hasn't really been any evidence of what type of activities took place on them. And the entire site itself has it's a homogeneous distribution of artifacts. So nowhere on the site seems to be considerably less density or certain types of artifacts absent. Some people have said, oh, this area seems to have more microlithic tools, or this area seems to have more this. But the overall evidence, there's not enough evidence to make those arguments, really. What it comes down to is, throughout the entire site, you find hundreds of clay balls, which are essentially the Poverty Point equivalent of, like, throwing a rock in the fire and getting a firecracked rock, except there's no rocks. And you get figurines and tons of other variants of lithic material, which, again, I'm not the biggest expert on this. But what it comes down to is that we have no post circles to know where houses might have been. The plaza, we don't really know if it was a plaza in the sense that when you think about it, some sort of open gathering space. We don't know how many people live there because there's evidence that tons of people were there, but there's no clear understanding. Was that completely a seasonal population? Was it a permanent population? The current accepted theory is that there was a partial seasonal population. Sorry, a partial year-round population with a larger seasonal influx. Again, though, there's not really enough evidence to make that some sort of...
So what are you doing at Poverty Point? What's been your approach?
Yeah, so now that I've described Poverty Point, what's my approach? Well, I think that this is going to be... To contextualize what I'm doing at Poverty Point, I think I need to describe a little bit about how I got to Poverty Point in the first place. So, as I said earlier, my goal for my dissertation was to find a way to blend experiences of place with GIS. So I wanted to develop a methodology that used both tools in conjunction and that made an argument or that evaluated whether or not, one, the two could even work in combination, two, that in combination they provided a greater... one of the primary goals of my dissertation was to evaluate the benefits and capabilities of ability to combine the power of GIS or geographic information systems with a phenomenological or experiential with experiential understandings of landscape. And to do that, I needed to find a way, I needed to develop a framework to actually put those two different techniques in dialogue. Phenomenology had really no clear methods that exist, and GIS has a ton. So I essentially found Poverty Point as a site to start developing this method. But to do that, I wanted to develop an approach that would be usable on sites that aren't Poverty Point. So I went to the field. So I went to Poverty Point for 2 weeks in 2023. And this was essential to me because I didn't want to start doing GIS work or any type of analysis on a place that I didn't visit first, because in my master's, that led to a lot of discomfort for me, and writing up a dissertation in some convoluted way that made it sound like you knew this beforehand or whatever. So I went to Poverty Point with the singular goal of trying to figure out types of questions I could ask and learning a bit about the site. My dissertation has no excavation component, which was fine. I think that it was developed during COVID, where there was a chance you couldn't even properly visit sites. But so I went to Poverty Point, and just during that scoping expedition is what I refer to it as, I basically did walking surveys of the site, talked to the site archaeologist, went to the interpretive center. I captured lots of photographs and stuff like that. And I just tried to get a sense of the place. And once I was done there and returned from the field that first time, I started to develop a series of questions. In fact, I think I had like 4 pages of site-specific research questions about things that interested me. And a lot of them came down to function, because that is kind of the unclear area of the entire site, is functionally why it was built and how it was used. So use and function. And yeah.
So in some ways, this is like you're sort of digitizing Tilly's like walk the Dorset cursus kind of thing, right?
Yeah. So so Christopher Tilly was kind of the archaeologist who introduced phenomenology to archaeology.
And the listener can't see this, but as Ken said that, he looked very smug and then took a gigantic hit off a bong.
Yeah, the phenomenological side does get inspiration from Christopher Tilly, but also discussions by Tim Ingold, who's an anthropologist, and James Gibson, who is a psychologist, I believe, or something. I forget at this point. Environmental psychologist, as I believe, or environment. So, but anywho, their methods were not methodological. Tilly, I picture him walking the landscape, I don't even know, smoking a cigarette or something, taking it all in. And Tim Engel literally talks about sitting in places and just letting the wave of the world wash over him. But
like I said,
yeah.
Pouring water on rocks.
Yeah. But there's something there about the experience of the place that was critical. And I wanted to create a method for that type of approach because I think it combines well with GIS. So I basically, working with those research questions from Poverty Point, or that I created based on my experience there the first time, I distilled my multitude of questions down to 5 lines of inquiry. And what that means is some of my questions had inquiries into movement, understanding how people move throughout the site and so forth. The other ones were visibility. So things like, would you be able to see people approaching the site? Or coming up to the site, would you be able to see it? And I also had questions about layout, because that was something that people didn't really, again, we know where the earthworks are, but where were the, and people assume houses were on, like these ridges, people assume that they held houses or dwellings. I don't want to say house, because then that gives you a picture in your head. But they assume people lived on top of them. They're wide enough you could, and there's theories abound as to why people lived on top of it. But we don't know how houses were distributed. We don't know how activities were distributed throughout this plaza and so forth. So questions about layout. I also want to know about interaction. People lived on the ridges and worked in this site and produced things. And again, there's a lot of questions about interaction that weren't clear. And the final thing is hydrology. I want to understand how water worked at the site, because one of the theories for why the ridges were elevated, as why they're ridges, were to function as basically platforms to build houses on so that they didn't get wet in rain. And to me, that was interesting, but considering this ridge is 20 feet above the Mississippi floodplain, whether it ever flooded was, I'll tell you right now, it never did. Like, water never got that high. You would have to have some sort of Noah's Ark style flood to get up there. And I don't think there was Noah was in North America. So,
could it be?
Yeah, I know, right? So then now that I had those five lines of inquiry, I wanted to look at them with GIS and phenomenology. So I basically, the GIS is pretty straightforward. GIS has a ton of pre-existent tools to analyze landscapes, and for archaeologists, it's great because using just that LIDAR data, elevation data alone, you can do a ton of stuff. So I wanted to create view sheds, which basically evaluates kind of mathematically using a bunch of algorithms where what places in the landscape are visible from a specific point in space. So you just say, hey, a person stood here, and it tells you what's visible. And then because it's computer-based, an algorithm, you can just say, okay, there was people in all these thousands of spots. How much of this massive amounts of landscape could they see? Which helped address questions about what's visible. And would also help with interactions, because you know, well, who you possibly interact with. I mean, just purely the fact that you can measure distances in GIS, which is another tool I wanted to use. So that's two, view sheds, measurements. Also just visually analyzing the imagery. Getting a bird's eye perspective, as Ken mentioned it earlier, like a top-down view, is obviously not what people in the past would have. People in the past didn't have wings or airplanes or satellites. But humans are very adept at recognizing patterns, and getting a different perspective of the landscape provides, kind of increases our ability to recognize existent patterns in the landscape. So just visually analyzing imagery from a different perspective, i.e. kind of top down, was important. Doing least cost path analysis, something Ken brought up earlier, which is essentially saying, okay, well, what's the easiest and simplest way for somebody to move from point A to point B? There's a ton of different things you can use to calculate what cost would be. The most basic being people prefer not to walk uphill, upslope, so they try to minimize the amount of slopes they need to walk up. And how would that go? And then I did a hydrological analysis. So just like my master's, basically I wanted to see how water flowed throughout the site. And that was the GIS tools. But then came the issue of phenomenology, which Ken pointed out. These archaeologists who had done phenomenology stuff, it tended to be a very, I don't even know what the word, I'm going to be appropriate, a very methodless approach that seemed to be more kind of a stream of consciousness rather than...
I'd like to know what the explicit version of that is.
Well, yeah, maybe. it tended to be more of a stream of consciousness rather than any...
Heidegger, hardly know it.
Yeah, my God, trying to read Heidegger is horrible. I gave up. I just read somebody's interpretation of or somebody's reading of it. But yeah, so there was no methods. People tended to just meander about experiencing a place, going with the flow, and then just sitting in their armchair smoking a cigar, writing their thoughts down, which is great unless you want to reproduce that or do anything meaningful with it beyond. So I developed five different approaches to study five different tools to complement the GIS tools. I can't go into huge details about that, it'd take too long. But the point is I developed five methods, which took a huge amount of time, to look at, to complement each of those GIS-based tools. Two of those approaches I used are really pulled from a paper, it's Hamilton et al. 2006, I believe, is the paper. And it's basically, they are approaching the similar issue to me. And they were trying to create methods for phenomenological analysis. So What am I doing at Poverty Point then? To back to the question that was originally asked. Well, now that I have had these five lines, after I have visited the field for the scoping expedition, developed research questions, I now have these five lines of inquiry I want to explore. And I had selected basically 10 tools, so five GIS tools, or five, we can think of those as five scientific or five quantitative tools, and then five phenomenological tools or five qualitative tools or non-scientific tools, whichever terminology you want to use. And basically, I went to the site this past summer along with one of my committee members who is a geographer, Dr. Johan Abrech. He works at Hunter College. And we, for three areas in the site, so I didn't bother working with the mounds, but for the ridges, the plaza, and this slope that goes from the plaza to the bayou, which people have deemed the dock.
Yeah, where the you see the artist depictions of people pulling their canoes.
Yeah,
up to it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know. I didn't talk about that, but essentially, yeah. It's a partially modified slope, and it's very unique in that the rest of it is this 20-meter cliff, and then here we have this gradual slope. So I basically went with him and performed GIS analysis, or I performed the GIS analysis of these three areas, trying to address and get insight into those five different lines of inquiry. Then I got a hype, and then all of this was focused on trying to deal with the function, right? I talked about how a lot of the questions about function and use are not answered in any concrete way. With this GIS toolkits and tools, I basically wanted to gain insight into function by looking at visibility, movement, etc. And I then created a bunch of hypotheses to answer every single one of my research questions, to which I had this massive Excel document, question, hypothesis for GIS. So then in the field, Dr. Albrecht and I used the five phenomenological methods that I developed to also try to answer those research questions. And a lot of that, so what did that look like in the field? Well, before the field, the GIS stuff looked like me sitting in front of a computer, clicking a bunch of buttons, typing in some code, modifying images. Not much to describe there. But in the field, what it looked like was we would walk paths and record. So, for example, phenomenological site catchment analysis was a method talked about in that Hamilton article I mentioned. I modified it. It was originally developed to basically record paths from and to a site. So what would somebody experience walking from a site away and back for some predetermined amount of time? What parts of the landscape or whatever? I modified it to basically look, okay, what would somebody experience walking between point A and point B at Poverty Point? So Johan and I basically did that. We walked between the plaza and each of the mounds, recording what we observed. And these forms I created were accompanied by a bunch of mobile phone-based applications. So I used an application called WalkMeter, which tracks using GPS your exact walking route and then exports it as a file that you can manipulate, so put into GIS or whatever. We also used an application that I learned about when I worked with Cora. So, and it's called a timestamp app. It's basically, it takes a photo, but then as a kind of watermark on the photo, you can put your GPS coordinates, the time of day, your location, the weather, all this information so that it gives context to the photos. And finally, have you ever seen those 3D spherical photos where you can it's like
what Google Maps uses, basically.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So we also used those. So those are the three phone applications we used. So while we were walking,
you don't need to tell Ken twice. I mean, he's in a mode right now where he can smell color. So the
since
this goes on much longer, we're gonna have to smash his guitar on the wall of Delta House. So sorry.
No, fine. I just talk and talk. So we basically walked between areas of interest, so plaza, mounds, etc. Recording anything that we observed of interest, while we were doing that, and using apps to record our movement, trying to kind of be comparable with things like least cost path. So all the time we did it basically based on what the GIS said would have been the least cost path, or what we perceived while walking was the what would have been the most effective route. Basically trying to create a least cost path based on a combination of our experience in the field and what we know the computer said. And we also then just walked a direct route, like as a crow flies between these points. And for purely practical purposes, we couldn't go between all the locations you could that the GIS analyzed. So we selectively chose areas that were that we could then kind of synthesize and kind of extrapolate what other paths would have been. We also created visual horizons, which is another thing talked about in Hamilton. But this, again, can be you can think about it in terms of view sheds. Essentially, what we did was we positioned ourselves on different points in the landscape, so on top of parts of the ridges, the plaza, then the mounds, or whatever, and drew our perception of distance. So this wasn't our Cartesian representation of space, but it was a 300, like a spherical, not spherical, like circular representation of perceived distance. So we had it, so I basically had a diagram which was three concentric complete circles. Each one represented a different distance from the subject, so near, medium, or far. And you then drew the landscape around you, so you slowly turned in directions and drew it, based on how far you perceive things to be. So it wasn't a top-down view, but instead almost like snapshots in each direction, where what you're recording is how far something seems, not how far something is. Like it didn't... And this also allowed us to see what was visible from points in space, right? And beyond that, we did do the normal walking the landscape kind of freestyle, like Tilly or somebody would have done. And we did a few things to assess layout. So we used some data comparable from other sites where there was, for example, houses. There was a house on a... They found a complete post circle in Jackson Place, which is... They had a poverty point era component. And we used that as kind of an analog and literally created this massive PVC pipe that was 3.7 meters long, which was the diameter of one of these housing of that post circle, and went on the ridges and kind of plopped it down, and using only our bodies and the PVC pipe, tried to extrapolate what would make sense for us layout-wise. Recording all the details of it, taking diagramming it, and taking excessive notes. And that was basically what we did in the field. We used these five methods, which each I had this extensive form of what to do and then what you have to record. Because I wanted to maintain consistency. I wanted to mean somebody else could go out into the field, take this form, and do the exact same thing. The results might be different, which is critical that you have the ability to do that. But they could follow the same process, allowing basically different people to follow the same steps, and then you could actually objectively evaluate the differences in their observations based on the fact that you used everything the same to get there. And that was all we did in the field. There was no digging. I mean, Johan saw the artifact collections at the site or whatever. But basically, we wanted to perceive space and the site in a structured way. And I wanted to be able to then use that to compare with the GIS stuff. And I mean, a few interesting things that came out of all that was, I mean, and a lot of this is I kind of knew going in kind of thing, which is part of why I did this, but it kind of shows you. So a few things. So again, I was trying to evaluate the benefits and possibilities of combining these tech-based approaches with on-the-ground experiencing of landscapes and how perceptions can help you make sense of space. And obviously, I incorporated technology into the actual experiential approach because, one, it provides you actual data, and two, like the quantitative data, but two, it also provides a way to combine it in a meaningful manner with your computer-based analysis. So the few things that came out of it is that there GIS and using like remotely sensed data, one of the big limitations is that it pierces vegetation. Whereas,
so you don't get to see the vegetation, which is important to your sensor experience if you're there in real life.
Right. Like somebody in the past, they would see, they wouldn't see magically through the trees. So things would obstruct their view. Additionally, on top of that, it, like your highway example you said, in terms of finding the best way to path, it really likes to path you along this highway that bisects the site. So somebody built in the, in, people have built a highway right through the middle of the site. It's just there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Every type of least cost path analysis loves that highway. Yeah, they all walk along it because it's flat. And it, they have a hard time getting off because there's ditches on both sides, which introduces slope, right? So the GIS, basically, if you want to cross between that point and that point, it really has a hard time with the fact that there's a highway. Also, all the modern and contemporary erosion caused by farmland means that there's a part of the site where there is this massive runoff gully that has been expanded by farming outside of the heritage site. That whole section of the site, the GIS analysis is essentially useless because it doesn't know what to do with this massive amount of erosion. It's just a mess. It can't path through it. It can't model hydrology through it. It can try to do view, but like it doesn't really make sense. So that was a limitation, which in the field, you see trees. Your view's obstructed by certain things. Your view's obstructed by trees. You can tell, you can go and try to make interpretations of this messy area without actually having to be basically stymied by the fact that it is a mess. And what that then tells you is, okay, are these things actually visible? For example, there is a feature in the landscape that's like 3 miles south of the site or something. I can't believe I'm using miles, but that's what they talk about. Anyway, it is
67 kilometers for the listener. That's
yeah. I think it's 68 maybe. and the GIS says you could see this feature from the site because there's nothing in the way. Okay, sure. There's nothing in the way, but a human being standing in this place, like at a specific spot in the landscape, seeing something that far away, whether or not the photon hits your eye does not mean you can quote unquote perceive it. Like it's, you need being able to distinguish something at that distance and actually seeing it, like having the light from it hit your eyes, is two different things. And the GIS doesn't consider the question of can you make sense of what your eyes are seeing? Or for them, as long as one pixel, or think about it, like one bit of light would reach your eye, well, that's visible then. And that's fine if you can then contextualize it by the fact that being in the place shows you that there's a limit, right? But there's archaeologists who will do least cost path analysis or visibility analysis without actually returning then to the place and kind of reining in what the GIS says to what is more realistic.
Yeah, I get the sense that your research is kind of pulling on this sort of cautionary tale about like that, you know, there's really these tools that we have like GIS and remote sensing and LIDAR and all this stuff is really fantastic. And you see lots of like National Geographic articles about finding all these like, you know, new city states in the middle of the jungle or in the Amazon or something like that. But that there's very little that you can trade without kind of ground truthing and actually going out and doing some of the practical, very practical archaeology work that still needs to take place in addition to these robust mapping tools, basically.
Well, that's exactly it. I chose Poverty Point because it had been extensively excavated. And because I wasn't able to do that myself for financial constraints, time constraints, and also I didn't want a whole program that I had this bunch of material that I need to deal with on top of everything else. But I wanted that because it provided something to kind of evaluate the conclusions you reached using these technological approaches. And I'm glad you brought up the constant news articles about cities discovered in the Amazon. Because on the one hand, it is excessively powerful. The fact that these technologies can penetrate dense rainforests means we can see ground features, what's on the ground, removing these copious quantities of vegetation. And that, it's not that if we were in that space, we wouldn't be able to see these, right? It's that the man and woman hours to kind of survey and walk that amount of space is, nobody's going to pay somebody to do that, and nobody's going to trudge through this dense jungle foliage to see what they can find. So they have remote, so being able to just fly a plane over, look at this data and say, oh, look, we found these actual structures here underneath, is exceedingly powerful. But the question you pointed out about ground truthing is an interesting one, because all LiDAR data and remotely sensed data is ground truthed. What do you think that means?
Is that a rhetorical question or is that a direct
question? I'm asking you what you think they do. When I say it's been ground truth, what do you think they do?
I'm guessing it's that they got anchor points that they tie into the, you know, the global positioning system, you know, or like the, you know, you've got your known knowns on the ground, basically.
Yeah.
They do it with, they shoot tennis balls to see if they bounce the same way the lasers do. This is a little known fact about LiDAR.
Yeah. Sometimes basketball, sometimes golf balls, depending on how dense the foliage is.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, okay, you're right. That's what they do. The thing is, the archaeologists...
I knew I'd be right, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely. Yeah, so it's not even the archaeologists who do that. It's whatever company captured this data. But archaeologists will often then look at the data, identify features, and I'm not saying it's the individual archaeologists, but the way it's conveyed in popular media, and even sometimes archaeologists will then see an expansive area with shapes that look like structures. And then based on that, we found a massive city discovered in the rainforest. And then if you look at more, this data is ground truthed. Now, that implies that the results of what they're saying their interpretations are ground truthed. But that's not always the case. Often it just means somebody had, as Ken pointed out, basically GIS like posts that they use to confirm that the alignment
monuments, that's what they're called. I was trying to think of the
Central Park has some monuments left from the survey grid, but basically monuments they use to basically take that image and make sure it kind of stretched and fit in the landscape properly. But are those houses? Is this a massive city? Is it just some structures? Is it part of something else? What do you mean by massive? Like, it is great that we can see it, but in the current post-COVID era where people have started to realize you can work from home or do work from home, and also in a world where funding for archaeology seems to be hard to come by often, do things that cost a little bit of money, like, or very little money, but that can have sensational results, are more and more, unfortunately, the direction things go. And I find it rather scary that, and this is kind of one of the big things for my dissertation, as Ken pointed out, is that we like our technology. We like what it shows us. And there is scary, in my head, there's a lot of parallels that can be drawn with early processualism and in the current era of GIS and mapping, where there is a obsession or kind of fascination with technology without having that critical part there. And particularly when we are working with a technology that we are just borrowing, as we do with most things, from another discipline. And
yeah, it's like that. It's that whiz bang effect. It's like you see all these 3D scans of like empty excavation units, and it's like, okay, that's great. You know, we know what the excavation unit. What is the value of this empty box in this 3D scan? You know, like what am I gaining out of this that I can't get from measuring a unit profile and drawing a plan view, right?
And what are you losing is the question I would ask.
Yeah, a ton of time and memory on your computer is essentially what I think it comes down to.
Yeah. Well, if you look at like any big conference in archaeology over the past decade, I would say they all have begun to have sessions devoted to GIS or technology and archaeology. And we, I think that one thing we as archaeologists need to begin to do is really appreciate the power of these, but contextualize it within the realities of what it's actually offering. We don't want to be like stuck in that, we don't want to return to a processual era where we're just fascinated in presenting a ton of results about based on technology or using technology without actually kind of, without being critical of it. And
forgetting there's humans that
forgetting there's
we're kind of interested in, right?
Like, or forgetting that this is an impersonal method, right? It's not, and asking what it's not showing us, because I don't really care. Like, cool, there we now have LIDAR of the entire plains, for example. We can map how people might have moved. Okay. What is the significance of that? How does that, what do we use that for? Do we then say, okay, people walk these paths, let's publish a paper? I don't believe you should. I believe if you're using this data to then see what, to then, I don't know, assess the visibility of this site, because you have the data, it's cheap, you can do a project where you analyze it with a bunch of different variables that doesn't increase the cost beyond your time and computing power. But then, like, back to what Ken mentioned earlier, what is the question? Why? Why does it matter? What is the significance? How are we relating that back to cultural questions? And how are we relating that back to the world itself, right? Like, are we going to go see if people actually walk this, or are we just going to keep it as a hypothetical?
My big question out of your research is the Caney Triangle a real thing?
What?
Those nested triangles that Poverty Point and all these southeastern earthworks kind of fit into this, like, that scales of six thing.
Where is that written up?
That's
again?
I've Eastern, seen that just Eastern recently. Archaic historicized. And
that's it, where it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like the Loch Ness Monster. It's all real.
Yeah.
I mean, and that, but jokes aside though, there have been two papers, I think, published about Poverty Point that have suggested the astronomical alignments exist. And they basically took top-down views of it and looked at azimuthals and stuff and seeing where sun would rise at certain points and made connections and suggested that there's sight lines here or that these things are aligned on a north-south axis, which has this significance. And drawing parallels with things like Stonehenge and megalithic earthworks in Europe. And on the one hand, there's one group of people who might say that's fascinating. These are people definitely designed this. It wouldn't be happenstance. Then there's the people on the other end who are a bit more hesitant or cynical, like me. But there's also the question of the real problem there for me is if you're looking, like I said earlier, people are really great at analyzing patterns and finding patterns. Even if they're not there, is what I think we need to add to that. And when we have a place we're looking at from a perspective that would not have existed or been possible to achieve in the past, you can't fly up ahead. Yet you can make the argument that in some places in the world where there's pyramids or mounds or very tall things, you can get a pseudo top-down perspective. But at the end of the day, if we're looking and finding patterns based on a particular top-down view, and we're saying things like these people created these alignments, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but just the pure fact that you're able to draw these or identify patterns does not necessarily mean that pattern is real. And
this is like when my wife is watching hockey games and she gets totally annoyed by the all of the commentators now. Their big thing is that they do these they draw triangles and they talk about, like, they take three guys that are on the ice and they're all kind of framing up to go take a shot, and they're like, look at the triangle that they're building here, and she's like screaming at the TV, you picked 3 points, of course you're gonna make
exactly
a triangle,
right? but that's exactly
well, the
it.
Great thing about that too is that as an American I can attest to the puck being invisible. So this really actually,
I mean,
is
depends on, I find it's invisible. I don't think it exists sometimes, but
yeah,
you can't ever see that.
Yeah,
there.
So So being mindful a little bit of our Courvoisier status here as we loop through here, what we might get you to do, David, is also send us some of the links here to the apps that you've mentioned.
Yes, I can do that.
The Hamilton article and those papers about Poverty Point. But I wondered if there were any sort of comments about, and I think you've given us a lot to think about. And in many ways, your research, I think, phenomenology as a cautionary tale is kind of an interesting perspective, I think.
I wrote down the quote, asking what it's not showing us, kind of these questions about technology and how we, you know, we sort of, this is the kind of the, you know, the argument of the point and shoot nature of like handheld XRF and things mm-hmm. like that, right? Like how we, and you brought in too how we sort of blindly use these tools because they're interesting, but they're not developed by archaeologists for archaeological applications.
They're developed by other people for other people's applications, which is not inherently bad. But if we don't understand how this data is captured, how it's processed, how it's different, like what types of artifacts may be into it, but also if we're just using it to use it, if we're beginning by saying, I want to do a project that uses this, rather than I have a research question I want to answer and these tools might help, there's a problem. I think archaeologists need to be excited that there's new methods, but not use methods for method's sake or because it's the cheapest option. You need to have those questions that relate to the archaeological record you need to answer first. Or want to answer, and then you select tools that work. And I would add, you should select tools that give different types of perspectives on the same place. So qualitative experience in quantitative GIS-based methods, for example, in my case. And because at the end of the day, there's a really good quote that... If I can find it really briefly, and I know that time is of a essence, but if not, I'll summarize it out loud. I just won't be. Yeah. So, Allison Wiley said once, or kind of, and I'm going to paraphrase this, but that synergies between research fields are crucial to the credibility of archaeological knowledge claims, specifically that the epistemic authority, so the authority of archaeological knowledge claims, is achieved not when it is scientific or not when it is non-scientific, but rather when archaeologists can exploit the unities and disunities between those divergent perspectives. So when archaeologists can use two different methods to approach a research question, two very different types of approaches that provide what may by some seeing is incompatible, quantitative and qualitative stuff. If those two approaches tell you the same thing, the chances that result is significant or true is much higher if both things are in agreement or disagreement. Again, you have different perspectives, but it's that synergy between these divergent approaches, different methods, that can give credibility to those knowledge claims. So if you go into a project, you need, in my opinion, you need to be going in with to approach the question, not just to use a method. And you need to be critical of both.
These sound like important lessons to leave the listener with.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's an excellent message. And
so thank you so much, David. What is the, I know I, you're not, we're never supposed to ask anyone this, but when can we expect to start seeing some of this in print?
Define in print. Do you mean when will my dissertation be done? Or do you mean when will I publish an article?
I left it vague because I didn't want you to think I was wearing a wire that your supervisor had given me.
Oh, yeah, well, my plan
is... Never mind. Just let us know when it's ready.
No, I will answer. So I will be done my dissertation by August for sure. Maybe sooner, maybe later. It depends on how many hours a day I can work.
How much time you're at the gym?
Well, no, it's not even the gym. It's how much time my brain works. But maybe if I'm at the gym longer, though, maybe I will get more done. So you're right. Yeah. Maybe I should think about that.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that, David. And thanks very much for coming on with us.
Yeah, thanks so much, David. This was a great conversation. We'll get you on again, maybe to pick your brain about like AI and other things.
Oh gosh, yes. Hopefully, I didn't meander too much with my ideas. No, I tend to just talk. So
not at all.
Do not worry. The listeners used to can. This was nothing.
Yeah, exactly. An hour on Poverty Point is like, you know, feels like 5 minutes compared to me talking.
Yeah, well, I guess if he can do it, I can too, so.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you very much,
thanks again,
David. We'll talk to you later.
Well, Ken, I think it's time for hit pieces.
I think it is.
And we've got a real sort of exciting, just clean out the hit pieces for the new year. So we've got a bunch of hit pieces tonight. And I think that also kind of speaks to, it's been a pretty good year in Northeast archaeology.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's probably been a banner year. We should get Trevor to do some bibliometrics, actually, on the last, 2 years in Northeast archaeology or something like that, you know?
We should. I mean, I think the articles in... Papers in Honor of David Black probably rival, just in terms of metrics, some decades in this business.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. Like it's been pretty cool to see. But I think, you know, I think we've talked about this a lot, that there's sort of a pretty new and active generation. So, you know, I think that this, probably in the early to mid 90s, this was kind of this, you know, late 80s, early to mid 90s kind of thing. This was pretty par for the course.
That's right. Yeah, it was just ayahuasca and publishing all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
Remember that, listener. So. Get your entry in. But our first thing actually is a topic that, you know, I think the kind of late Paleo-Indian period is one of these things that's super interesting and it but kind of gets a little overshadowed because it's hard to find and it doesn't have those hyperdiagnostic fluted points. But Nathaniel Kitchell.
Major transitions, folks. That's the interesting stuff.
It is, exactly. It turns out, Ken, that like other transitions, this transition is complicated.
It is.
And it seems like we don't 100% know what's going on, but Nathaniel Kitchell is fixing that for us, and along with his colleagues. And he's kind of taking an approach that mixes fieldwork with environmental reconstruction.
Yep.
And improving radiocarbon chronologies, basically, to try to tighten up. So the gist of this is there's questions about like radiocarbon gaps and temporal gaps and that people are possibly moving around at the end of the Paleo-Indian period.
Yeah. So to scale out, listener, what we're talking about is a period of time probably between about 11,700 years ago and about 10,000 years ago is kind of, or well, really 11,700 to 11,000-ish, basically.
Something like it's that,
about
yeah.
700 to 1,000 year period. At the beginning of the Holocene period. So this is the end of the Younger Dryas. So this is essentially the end of the Ice Age and the beginning of the Holocene. And for, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on technologically, culturally, among other things, and it coincides with this major climatic event. And as Nathaniel points out in this paper called Facing the Forest, Climate Change, and Human Adaptation Across the Pleistocene Holocene Transition in Northern New England and Eastern Canada. And this is in Paleo-America, Volume 10.
In Canada, he actually means Quebec. He does not mean the Maritimes, which is something we can return to.
Yes, because I think we mentioned this in the last episode, that we've stumbled across some of the very few, most 90% of what we think is probably the collection of late paleo stuff in New Brunswick. So you want to run with that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, but basically he's just sort of chasing out this kind of hiatus in archaeological radiocarbon dates. And he deals with basically some of the things that are involving the climate change issues. So basically you've got this change from open spruce forest parkland and tundra to closed canopy forest. And this is a big deal because it's sort of like, why is there this dramatic cultural shift? What did people do? Did they go somewhere? Why is there this kind of hole in archaeological radiocarbon dates? And this is part of a big project that he's doing. He has some sort of gigantic National Science Foundation grant. And so I think we're going to keep hearing more about this. And I was fortunate. I did some fieldwork with him at the Weir site, where he's also digging up some of these sites, or like revisiting sites that were already reported. And that was a lot of fun and super interesting. And so I think we're going to hear more from Nathaniel about this.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is like, it's really cool too, because it's like one of these things that you see. So you have the unflute, it goes from fluted points to unfluted points, these stem points that we talked about last episode, Claude Chapdelaine's
lanceolates. Yeah. Yep.
Lancelets, lancelet points. But it's also, as Nathaniel has written about, and I've written about, and a bunch of other people have, that you also see this major shift in lithic materials too. So you have a shift from fluted point groups seem to prefer very fine grain, very brightly colored cherts and other fine grain materials. And then there's this kind of adoption afterwards of coarser grained rhyolites and that sort of thing. And so pretty interesting argument.
After the way you pronounce lanceolate.
What's that?
I like to call them rhyolates.
Rhyolates?
Yeah, yeah.
Lanceolate, you don't ever say that?
Isn't it lancelate? Do I say it wrong?
No, I think lancelate's probably right, but I find sometimes I say lanceolate.
I like the way you say it. It's a little more sophisticated.
Is it?
I feel like it's like someone said in a department meeting I was in recently, instead of specialty, specialism or something like that.
Or speciality?
No, I think it was specialism.
It's like when you say, instead of extraordinary, you say extraordinary.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. It's like the difference between long-lived and long-lived. It's mostly about how snooty you are. And I don't know, and I mean, based on that chair that you have, I would say you're a lanceolate man, not a lancelet man.
Yeah, I think you say lanceolate when you're in a wingback smoking a pipe or something.
Yes, well, exactly. So you'd think I'd say lanceolate more.
Yeah.
But so that's exciting. Congratulations to Nathaniel on getting that out. It's been exciting to see a lot of these. There's been a lot of work lately on periods that are called either late or transitional, and that's kind of exciting because those are some of the big problems. And our next one, though, is also kind of exciting. It's a news article, and it's called Earliest Islander. And this is about Prince Edward Island, and it is about a important collaborative archaeology project between the Mi'kmaq and the province that ultimately led to the radiocarbon dating of a human jawbone fragment to 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, and so this was this is basically the oldest dated ancestor of the Mi'kmaq on Prince Edward Island. And so it's the title of this CTV Atlantic is 5,000-year-old human jawbone fragment found on PEI. And so ELNUE, which is the consultation group that works to advance the rights of the island's Mi'kmaq population, it was a find made by a swimmer, basically. They reported it to the authorities. It doesn't get into a ton of detail about the consultation process that took place over in the intervening period, but they made a determination that it was important to date this thing, and it came back with pushing back. We know that Mi'kmaq were in PEI for probably 12,000 years, and some of that record is probably underwater actually in the Northumberland Strait now. Mm-hmm. But
harvesting for oysters recently.
Yeah, and where Katrina. I did that marine archaeological survey years ago.
Yeah,
yeah. So
you missed this, is what you're telling me, Kat.
Missed it, yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. Although I didn't actually see where it was found on the island.
I suspect they were pretty intentionally vague about that, would be my
near Stanhope, which I think is on the north side of the island. But
I've been there, okay. But my geography of PEI is pretty questionable.
Yeah, so pretty interesting find, really great to hear about this collaborative approach that led to this work.
Absolutely.
And so the last one today is another, I feel like Bonnie's been really busy lately too.
She really has, and her students are tearing it up as well. So that research group out of UMaine has been doing incredibly well.
And so this is in the most recent SAA archaeological record, which actually I didn't realize that this one had come out. So I think mine is delayed in the mail, which is why, and I must have missed the email.
Oh, yes.
And so so this is called Third Space Pedagogy in Archaeology, Exploring Climate Change, Partnerships, and Site Stewardship in Wabanaki Homeland, Maine. And that article is by Bonnie Newsom, who's at the University of Maine. Catherine Schmidt and Rebecca Cole-Will, who I believe are her students. Is that correct?
I don't know who Catherine Schmidt is, but Rebecca Cole-Will is the National Parks archaeologist out of Bar Harbor. Or whose patch includes Bar Harbor.
Yeah. Does it say their affiliations here? Catherine Schmidt is the Skudik Institute in Winter Harbor, Maine.
Oh, very cool. Okay.
Or shoot, what would be the main pronunciation of that?
Skudik, I think.
Skudik? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got that
right. And so in pedagogy apparently refers to pedagogy that occurs as a hybrid setting where there's an interaction of different cultures that creates transcultural knowledge. And so what this paper is about is the way in which their field-based programs in the Wabanaki homeland work to kind of merge. It's almost like a kind of a building on two-eyed seeing sort of approach.
Yeah, and sort of putting it into action, basically, right?
Exactly. Like
And so it was built. It was kind of a three-week field school that had each week was a different thing, and so the first. There were four intersecting goals of it to develop student understanding of lifeways of past and present indigenous groups, to guide students through an exploration of archaeological research, to advance student knowledge and the relationship between climate change and heritage, and to build student skills in partner-engaged archaeology and science communication. So it's a really great article kind of highlighting sort of how the field school unfurled and the different experiences that the students had, but also why they took part in those experiences, basically.
That's right. Yep. And at some point here, we've got to get Bonnie on. I think one of the issues that we've both been struggling with is there's so many things we could ask Bonnie to talk about.
Yeah.
And the temptation to just be like, hey, do you want a season? would be tempting, but then it would, you know, she's really busy, as you can tell by the output that she's had. So
yeah,
it hasn't felt appropriate.
But yeah, so sounds like a really great field school opportunity. Did you guys meet up out in the field at any point? Did these field schools overlap?
I believe this is her kind of other field school that she does at Acadia.
Okay.
In Bar Harbor. So I didn't, but have certainly heard about it. Met her students. They're all great.
Yeah.
And this is also an open access
publication, but, yes.
Yeah, available open access, so anyone can get their mitts on this.
So if you hit the link in the show notes, listener, you'll have a chance to read through this as well.
That's right. And listener, I think that's our last hit pieces for the year.
Yes, for the calendar year 2024.
That's right, because we're just going to have a year in review episode to round out the year, I think. But it's been a good year, Ken.
It has been a good year, yeah. And I think we'll be talking about that in the next fortnight. And so, listener, I think you're probably going to want to set your dials to the NBArcPod on, I think, New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, I think was the idea. Is that correct?
Thereabouts. We're gonna drop the ep like the ball over Times Square or the sardine over Eastport, whatever you prefer.
Is that what they do in Eastport?
Yeah. I really want to go sometime. And then
and then
at 11 o'clock Eastern time they drop a maple leaf in honor of the Canadian New Year.
Oh, that's cool. So yeah. Is it a singular sardine?
Well, it's a large metal sardine. I think it's metal. It's a large.
Oh, okay. I just pictured like some guy up in a cherry picker, like dropping a single sardine. And just
I think that would be better.
The splat, yeah.
That would be
have
good.
Just a rapt crowd, all just totally quiet, and just
yeah.
a splat, and then yay! Like,
well, if anyone's listening in Eastport, that's what we'd like to suggest. But
yeah,
we should,
yeah.
If we get Shirk, we could broadcast live from. We could be like the. Well, I haven't seen it in a million years, but they have the celebrities that sort of broadcast from Times Square.
Oh yeah, the Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve or whatever it is.
Exactly, we could do the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast Rockin' New Year's Eve.
That would be great.
We could do it. You could stand in Campobello, and I could stand in Eastport.
Oh yeah,
and yep. we could
and do cheers over the international border.
We absolutely could. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm sure customs would be thrilled.
Oh no, I'm sure they'll give us clearance. That's
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
This is we're the media.
That's, yeah, excuse me, sir. I have a Nexus card. I don't understand what the problem is. All right. Well, I think that's our show for tonight. Thanks for tuning in, listener. And we'll see you in a fortnight for a Happy New Year's.
Yes. And since we don't talk to you before, happy holidays, folks. I hope you're all taking time to relax with friends and family over the next couple of weeks. And we will talk to you in a fortnight.